What's up, everybody? Welcome to Culture Binge, where we feast on everything going on in the zeitgeist and digest it all for you, our beautiful listeners. This is the episode for the week of July 8th, 2019. I'm your host, Jared, and with me today, as always, are my amazing co-hosts, Alec.
Hey.
And Serby.
Hi.
So Alec is here in LA today for VidCon. That's also the reason that we're not live streaming this week. We're hoping to start live streaming again next week, but because of schedules and video uploads and VidCon, we are just doing this for Wisecast and for RSS. But we will be regularly podcasting live as much as we can.
And we're on RSS now.
And we are on RSS now.
Yay.
So open up Google Podcasts, open up Apple iTunes, or what are the other podcast apps?
Stitcher, Spotify.
All that stuff. We are on it. So tell your friends, tell your mom, tell your mom's friends that this is the new podcast that you should subscribe to.
It's the cool new thing. And also leave a review. Unless you don't like it, then please don't leave a review.
Yeah. Anyway, so as always, we're going to start with what's been going on in y'all's lives. What slaps? What chaps your ass? Let's start with Serby. Serby, how's it going?
Really well. So what slaps is I briefly read this article about how rural cities now have access to telehealth. So the idea is that you can have like Skype calls or appointments with doctors and mental health professionals. So I think it's great because I think that something that's really difficult for people to have access to is mental health professionals. So now that there's this push towards telehealth, it expands these services to people who wouldn't normally have access to them. So I'm very excited about that. And what chaps? Nothing really chaps me this week. I'm doing very well.
Congratulations.
That's amazing.
I actually had a hard time thinking of something, but I did think of something.
Have you ever used the Walgreens app?
What?
No.
Yeah, the Walgreens. I mean, it sounds like what you're describing, but if you use the Walgreens app, you can just get connected with a doctor. You have to pay like $60 or something like that. It's expensive, but there was a time where I was very sick and I didn't have anyone to drive me to the doctor, and I was pretty sure that I could describe my symptoms and just get the appropriate medicine. And so I was just Skyping with this doctor in like North Dakota or something. And he said, yeah, it sounds like you got this. I actually did end up having to go to an emergency clinic to get the medicine that I needed, but it was interesting.
I have a little bit. So telehealth is really great, especially for people.
Is what I described telehealth?
I think so.
Yes.
I've never heard of it described in terms of Walgreens, but yeah. I mean, more or less, it's you're usually doing a video call with a doctor, could be a therapist, or even on the phone. And on one hand, it's like not only when you're sick and you can't get places, but people who are older or may not be able to drive for a variety of reasons and can't really get places, especially like in rural areas, super important. On the other hand, I have a specific bad experience, which is I was an RA at my dorm in college, and we were supposed to tell people there was like a 24/7 like nurse hotline where whatever was wrong with you, you could call, talk to an actual nurse and figure out like what you need to do. And no matter what, every time I heard anyone ever use it, they would tell you to go to the ER.
Mm. Yeah. So that has been my experience as well.
And then the thing is, I was an RA, so I had to go to the ER with them. So people were like, I was thinking about calling the nurse hotline. And I knew professionally I had to tell them to do that. But I was like, well, I don't know. Like, you know. And especially if you mentioned the word chest, it was you were having a heart attack. Like one person had like a really bad cough and their chest hurt from coughing. And the nurse on the phone, I was like trying to dissuade them from calling as much as possible, but they still did it. And the nurse was like, oh my God, you might be having a heart attack. Please go to the ER immediately. And I was like, God damn it.
All right, moving on. Alec, how's this week been for you?
This week's been pretty good. I was going to complain about LA public transit, but whatever. But what slaps, I'll start with slaps. I saw, it's an old movie, Deadfall. For anyone who's seen our Nick Cage video, they may be vaguely familiar with it. Even though you worked on that video, were not really aware of it?
I was aware that there was a movie that had clips like that, but I have not seen the movie.
Have you seen Deadfall, Serby?
No.
I'm sure you haven't. So it's a movie starring Nick Cage and some other people. Kyle Reese from The Terminator, whatever the actor's name is in it. Charlie Sheen is in it. There's another another Oscar-nominated actor or actress in it. Really kind of all-star cast. It was made for $10 million. It grossed $18,000. Yeah. So it is maybe one of the worst movies I've ever seen now, but it slaps because Nick Cage is incredible in his insanity. And I think which has a clip, yeah.
That was his fucking money.
Somebody's after your job, boy. I bet he even stole your woman.
Best Nick Cage freak out spot to happen.
Fucking shut my back!
Watch it now.
High fucking yaw.
I think high fucking
yaw is amazing.
That's so even though it's terrible, I recommend everyone check it out because it's amazing.
I can't wait.
And what's better, so this movie, as I mentioned, grossed $18,000 and lost millions of dollars. They made a prequel to it starring, I think, Adrien Grenier is in it and like a lot of other famous people.
Oh, so is it just a big cult hit among Hollywood types?
I don't even think that. I think it's just well known as being a terrible, terrible movie. Like, it's not like the Star Wars Christmas, maybe it is like the Star Wars Christmas special, but
the
prequel though was not like a few years after. It was made in the 2000s, over a decade after it came out.
The reason I ask if it's a Hollywood insider thing is because it seems like the kind of thing that only a bunch of celebrities could come together to make happen.
Maybe.
I don't know if anyone really saw it as a great investment opportunity, considering that no one has heard of the first one and it only grossed $18,000.
Yeah, and I think the newer one also cost a ton of money and may have grossed $40,000 or $60,000. I don't remember the exact number. And as far as what chaps, this is not something kind of on my radar. I don't know too much about it, but I've seen essentially a theory that... So what chaps is Twitter hashtags, and the reason is because there's often hashtags about people freaking out about stuff, usually a boycott of some company, whether from the left or the right. It's happening equally. But the sort of theory I've seen is that there's no actual, for instance, someone will say boycott X company, but you go on the hashtag and it's all people saying the people boycotting the company are dumb. So it's unclear if anyone's actually boycotting the company because the reaction to the boycott itself has so overcome whatever's happening. So my actual theory is that maybe one or two people suggested let's boycott XYZ, and then there's tens of thousands tweeting about how those two people are dumb.
So you're saying it's that people are dismissing a boycott for bad reasons? Is that what chaps your ass?
No. It's that boycotts will be trending in the hashtags, not because the boycott is popular, but because making fun of the boycott is popular. And it's unclear if the boycott even exists or if it's successful or if it's just a thing five people did. And it's not just boycotts. It'll be like, fans are mad that XYZ happened in this movie. And it's unclear how many fans are actually mad about it. Because when you...
Oh, sure.
Yeah, you could look through the hashtag for hours and maybe find one or two tweets about people who are actually mad. And the rest is just people making fun of those people.
Yeah.
So it's just eclipsed reality.
It's really hard to discern how many people are actually really mad at Star Wars and how many people are actually really pissed at Sonic, although I think the Sonic thing is pretty universal.
I think a lot of people are pissed about those things. One example from a while ago is people were mad at the new Star Trek Discovery when that was coming out, and I'm not convinced that more than five people were mad.
Mm. Have either of you participated in a boycott?
I'll be honest, a while ago when there was a boycott of Uber, I deleted the app.
Good for you.
But I got to be honest, it was probably not very well informed. I probably was just in an emotional mood and saw a headline and said, yeah, fuck Silicon Valley. Because I'm very much of a fuck Silicon Valley kind of person. Like, that's if one were to say I was a one issue voter, I have what really gets my...
What really chaps your ass?
What really chaps my ass or grinds my gears? But I mean that in the sense that it's like totally emotional, and what can totally override reason with me is my anger at Silicon Valley. And so whenever somebody makes an appeal to hating on Silicon Valley without even being well informed, I'll just be like, yep, fuck them, deleting the app, those fucking morons.
I'm glad you can admit that it's purely just reactionary.
Sure. Yeah. So now I only use Lyft.
What is it about Silicon Valley?
They have too much power. And there are a bunch of people that have a very specific kind of intelligence that is very good for creating apps that distract you but are not good for defining the social fabric of the country.
They're great problem solvers, but not good critical thinkers. They'll be like, I can solve this problem, but I might create 18 more problems, but I'm not going to think about that because I'm a disruptor.
Well, it's like Theranos. Like, Silicon Valley was just, everybody was just like touching themselves over that.
I guess, yeah, there are certain products I don't buy because of certain things the company have done. And sometimes I will half-heartedly do it. I'll try to avoid it. I mean, one is that I buy shit on Amazon. I know I shouldn't buy shit on Amazon. So when given the choice, or even with Uber, and again, this may be a little more emotional, I try to use Lyft when I can because it seems like Lyft is slightly better. But to be honest,
yeah,
are they equally?
It seems like. I don't entirely buy that there's any difference. It's just that we have a fetish for the underdog.
Yeah, that's totally fair. But there's another one that I've heard is better, Via, which is more like it's these big vans and you always have to sort of walk to the drop-off point and always have to walk to your house afterwards or wherever you're going. And allegedly they pay their drivers $35 an hour, which is totally like reasonable and are much better. And I tried to use it for a while, but stopped because it was wildly inconvenient. So what I'm saying is I'm a coward. I'm unwilling to stick to my moral scruples.
And I am still a victim of the intellectual laziness that pretty much dominates the entire society, whether or not you're willing to admit it.
Excellent.
What do you mean that?
Well, in saying that I boycotted Uber, or at least deleted the app, without really thoroughly investigating what people were pissed off about.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. All right, so what slaps for me is I saw some great movies over the weekend. I saw Midsommar, the new movie by the guy who made Hereditary, Ari Aster, and it was very, very good. We're actually covering it on our movie podcast, Show Me the Meaning, next week. And I also saw a movie called First Reformed, which stars Ethan Hawke. And it's written and directed by Paul Schrader, who wrote Taxi Driver. And this movie is kind of a spiritual sequel to Taxi Driver, but in my perhaps controversial opinion, I think this movie's better.
Whoa.
I actually don't love Taxi Driver. I like it, but I've only seen it twice, and both times I was like, I feel like this is one of those movies that I'm supposed to like more than I actually do. And First Reformed, maybe my expectations weren't very high, but it really affected me. All right, and as far as what chaps, I'm surprised that Serby didn't bring this up, but fucking Earthquakes.
No, I don't mind them.
You don't mind them? So for those, I mean, it's been all over the news. Honestly, what probably chaps my ass more than the actual earthquakes is that as soon as the earthquake happens and you're like, oh, that wasn't so bad, you go on every news site and the headline is devastation in Los Angeles as a 7.1 earthquake hits and it's total chaos. And I was like, I don't really see much chaos. And then for the next 2 days, it's all about should you move away from Los Angeles because the big one may be coming. It's overdue for the big one. And I'm like, man, I don't need this. Man, after that second one hit, I gotta be honest, I was, for the next day, I had like earthquake PTSD in that I was in the movie theater and the person next to me was just rather large. And when they were shifting in their seat, my seat moved. And I was like, wait, is this an earthquake again? Or is it just the person next to me?
Also, the due for the big one is, I think pseudoscience is the right word. Like, that's not how statistics work. It's like saying, when you're gambling, being like, you know, I've had shit luck this whole time. I'm bound to sort of go back to where I should be statistically, but that's not exactly. It's like if you flip a coin and it's tails 9 times and saying I'm due for a heads, that's not true. Your still chances are 50-50. So right now the odds of the big one are whatever they are, like 1 in 100,000 years or something like that. But yeah, when I saw that, and I don't mean this in a dick way, I'm going to sound like a dick. I really just wanted to know how many people died, if any, so I could be sad. No, well, not messed up. Like, I wanted to be concerned if there was concern or conversely, if people died, were a bunch of houses destroyed or people displaced? Like, that's what it is. But all I see is mostly actually on Twitter, like cynical millennials, making jokes. Which I'm down with. It's similar things whenever anything bad happens in New York. It's all just, this horrible thing happened.
I mean, how many people died, I guess, is a pretty solid statistic for how bad shit has been fucked.
Yeah. Or if there's fires, property, whatever. But did any of that? I honestly don't know.
There were some fires. Nobody died. But it wasn't in the Los Angeles area. It was outside of Los Angeles. How bad was it for you, Serby?
Not I mean, bad. You are, it I was think, just like I think some you're a little bit shaking, closer, right? But it wasn't. I've had earthquakes that were maybe like 4.3 or something that have been a lot closer, and that's when I was like that immediate like, oh, like this is scary, and like things like fell and books fell off the shelf and stuff like that. But this didn't bother me. But maybe because I grew up with earthquakes, they don't bother me as much. Like, it's not a scary thing. It just passes. Maybe because you didn't grow up here. I don't know.
Maybe. It was definitely the strongest one that I had ever felt. And I'm not someone who's usually paranoid about these things. But as much as I am critical of how the news media sensationalizes certain things, and I know that's how they make their money, and I know it's a horrible dystopia, I still think it affects me.
Yeah, it is scary. I think for me, like what frightens me more than an earthquake is wildfires. That's really frightening to me. Like my house gets evacuated every time there is a fire. And the house that I lived in before this one burnt down. And so that is like terrifying to me. Like as soon as I smell smoke in the air, as soon as like the sky gets a tiny bit dark or I hear it's like really high temperatures or high winds, I get really nervous.
Were you evacuated around this time last year?
Yeah.
When the fires? Oh, wow. Where do you go?
Well, it depends. So sometimes the freeways close all around us, so that's hard to leave. So it's difficult to like go stay at family's place. Sometimes like my family nearby will go to a hotel, or maybe we'll just like congregate in one area. Usually they put out the fire, the winds shift, so we're able to go back home. But last year we had to leave for a couple of days because the fires were across the street. So like my immediate family, my uncle, my cousins, we all had to leave our area.
Yikes. I'm sorry to hear that. Well, I'm glad that your house didn't burn down though, obviously.
Me too. Thank you.
I'm glad too, Serby.
Yeah. All right. So let me give you guys a little bit of a brief on what we're going to be talking about today. So we're going to start talking about reality TV. Is reality TV ruining reality? Then Serby's going to talk about the new update in a Goop scam. Alec is going to talk about YouTube demonetizing various videos, which is something that is very true to our heart. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about the true crime obsession on podcasts and media and all that stuff. And then Serby's going to bring in something about fertility clinics. So let's start off talking about reality TV. So have you guys ever seen the movie Best in Show?
Maybe clips, but I know the guy from American Pie's in it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the dad.
Yeah.
Is that the dog show, the dog thing?
It is the dog show movie.
Oh, okay.
It's a dog show mockumentary directed by Christopher Guest. It's a mockumentary about a dog show and all the quirky eccentricities of these evangelical dog people, basically. So neither one of you have seen it?
No.
I think I've seen parts of it.
Enlighten us, Jared.
So I rewatched it over the weekend because my girlfriend and I are similarly dog evangelicals.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you were thinking about putting them into the dog show.
Oh, no. No, I don't think I would. It's so much work.
You don't want Woody to feel that kind of
pressure. Plus, he's not a purebred. Neither of our dogs are purebreds. Mm. Anyway, I watched this movie. We rented it because we had fond memories of how funny it was, but it's not funny anymore. And this really chapped my ass, even though this is not Slaps or Chaps. And, you know, the whole premise of a mockumentary is that we show people that are in this quote-unquote real setting, and they are so obviously over the top that it becomes obvious that there's some sort of gag here. But your average reality TV show these days has people who are just as nuts, just as crazy, just as eccentric, to the point where it's not even as clear that there's a joke anymore. Because this mockumentary, the only thing that really differentiates it from stuff that you would see on reality TV is the fact that it's filmed on film and not on digital, and it has celebrities in it.
Right.
So it made me think a lot about what happens to a society as we start to dramatize reality and still put the tag reality on it. We all know, you and I both know, and Serby, that reality TV isn't real. There are producers, things are scripted, things are changed in the edit, etc. But I feel like if 20-year-old hyperbole isn't working anymore because it seems like it's just normal, then something is changing. So first I want to ask, do you guys watch any reality TV, and what is your general attitude towards it?
Serby.
I watch, oh, I don't know if I want to say, it's so embarrassing, but I'm also kind
of... I watch a fair amount of reality TV, so you're not going to be judged. You want me to go first?
No, I want Serby to go first. Yours is actually not that embarrassing.
Okay. I watched Teen Mom.
Yeah.
The original Teen Mom. I've been watching that not since Teen Mom 2. So for me, it's more of like, I've seen these girls like since they were like 16 and pregnant. And I'm like, oh, wow, like, what is your life now? And like watching that progression. So I look at it more as like kind of like a, not an experiment. I can't think of the word. But like, you know, when you're like watching, like a, kind of like a longitudinal study where it's like over the years, like how are they changing and how does fame change them? And then the other one I watched, just because it's wildly entertaining and completely different from my life, is Floribama Shore, because those people are just so weird. And I'm like, wow, I would never do that. Like, but I'm enjoying watching you do that.
Wait, is that just like Southern Jersey Shore?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Right? I think it is. I haven't seen it.
It's so good.
My girlfriend watches a lot of Teen Mom. And what's interesting is that I just think that I might have said this before. The juxtaposition is funny, and it's probably similar for you, Serby, but she like has a master's degree, but watches this, not a ton of reality TV, just this one terrible show. And I think she watches Teen Mom 2 as well. And the weird thing about Teen Mom that I've noticed, they sort of unveiled the curtain a little bit so that you can see behind, like now the producers of the show are also characters, which may or may not give it a veil of authenticity. When two characters are fighting, the producer will go in and you'll see the producer trying to calm them down, trying to get them on the show, or they'll do the recaps with Dr. Drew where they all talk and then there's drama about won't they go on the stage, and you see the behind the scenes of the producers trying to coax them to go on the stage, which maybe that also is fake, but that's kind of interesting. She also watches, and I watch these occasionally with her.
What you're saying is blowing my mind that they have meta reality TV now. Yeah. But go on.
The other one she watches, is it called The Roloffs now? It's Little People Big World or whatever that's spun off to be. There's that. The one that I used to watch when I was, I've kind of cut out a lot of mindless TV watching, but a few years ago I was really into Hardcore Pawn.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that one. Yeah, I have nothing but shame when I say that. I feel nothing but shame when I say that.
So I mean, I did say I was embarrassed about telling you about the shows that I watch, but in general, I'm not super embarrassed. Like my job is very stressful. Like I'm stressed out from the moment I wake up in the morning until the moment I'm done working. And when I watch something like reality television where I can just watch something like mindless and not think and not have to engage in something, it's relaxing to me. Like I don't have to exert any critical thinking skills.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost scary how good it is in that sense. I do the same thing. I consider my job to be pretty stressful. And reality TV, the reality TV that I watch a lot of food content. So I love Chopped. I love Guy's Grocery Games. I love the Great Food Truck Race is one that I watched recently. I really like on Netflix. Have you guys seen Nailed It?
Oh, yeah. That I did watch this first season. I feel like that show got kind of old. In that
the problem with that show is that they use fondant too much.
Yeah, fondant is, it's just everything. I'd rather see them do.
You might as well just use plastic.
Yeah, it's essentially a show about people's crappy like molding skills or what do you call that? Like not pottery.
Arts and crafts.
Sculpting.
Sculpting. Yeah, it's people's crappy sculpting. But I want to see people also be like terrible cooks in general. I want to see them terribly do other things.
All right. So my question is, as far as this.
Well,
there have been a lot of... No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I feel... No offense, Serby, because clearly I'm guilty. I feel your mindless entertainment is a little bit better, because at least in there is drama and it's artificial, but it's about, oh man, I messed up this dish, where other cooking shows like Hell's Kitchen with Gordon Ramsay is all that artificial, constructed human drama, where this is more, I guess,
I think we're just talking about degrees of artificiality, though, because I would argue that all of it is artificial. Now, a lot of the shows that I'm talking about are competitions, and I'm not necessarily saying that they weigh the scales in terms of who wins the competition, but there is a sense of narrativizing everything.
Sure.
Even on Chopped, for example, you notice that everyone they pick has some sort of sob story. Yeah. They all have some sort of, you know, not that I want to be insensitive to these things, and I don't think that they're made up, but I do think that the producers not only pick people based on do they have a good narrative mm-hmm. behind them. So either somebody got bullied as a kid, or somebody just got back from the war, or somebody's wife just died from cancer. Yeah. All these horrible things that are more or less exploited and optimized for entertainment because you want to have this kind of narrativized arc throughout it. By the way, if you pay attention to who, if you look at a episode of reality TV by beats and you pay attention to whose story is given the proper beats of the arc, you can pretty much guess who's going to win.
Oh, wow.
Because the editor is choosing, like, all right, in order to make this the most emotionally resonant, I obviously can't show all of the confessionals, all of the mm-hmm. content. I need to use the ones and sprinkle in certain narrative moments so that by the end, when this person wins, the audience has the most emotional fulfillment. So I'm actually reading this book that Alec sort of recommended to me.
I saw it mentioned on Wikipedia.
He saw it mentioned on Wikipedia, and we were actually scrambling for an angle on a video that actually just came out today. The book did not actually yield an angle, but it's called Reality Hunger by David Shields, and it's actually a very bizarre book. The whole book is essentially a collection of plagiarized aphorisms that he has compiled into a book under his own authorship to make some sort of greater point about how no one owns language, no one owns thought, that reality is actually something that's really hard to pin to. But in the book, he actually says something about reality that I think can speak to what I'm talking about with reality TV. He says the line between fact and fiction, actually, sorry, he doesn't say this. I had to look it up. It's actually, he plagiarized it from Jonathan Rabin's Love and Money. And the quote is, "The line between fact and fiction is fuzzier than most people find convenient to admit. There's a good case for arguing that any narrative account is a form of fiction. The moment you start to alter the world with words, you alter its nature. The words themselves begin to suggest patterns and connections that seemed at the time to be absent from the events the words describe." So, I guess what I'm saying here, and bringing it back to whether or not reality TV does have a harmful effect or an effect on reality, is that if it's branded as reality and people are consuming it as reality, are they more likely to emulate it than they would if, because I've always been, you know, when Columbine happened and everyone was blaming it on Marilyn Manson and South Park, I was always like, no, I'm pretty sure that people are actually pretty apt at discerning the difference between reality and fiction. And so if they see John Wick 3 and they see this guy headshotting a bunch of people, they're probably, I have faith that humans know that this is false. This is not something to copy. But with reality TV, where it's produced under the guise of being real, and it gives this sense, and by narrativizing these people's lives, it gives this almost this narcissistic tint to it, in that people believe that our lives, like the people we see, are somehow interesting enough to always be watched, or that they ought to be interesting enough to be watched, or that our lives should follow some sort of narrativization, some sort of narrative arc. But life isn't like that.
You know what this reminds me of?
Hmm.
There was an anecdote I heard, or an article, I don't remember at this point, but kids who were opening their gifts during Christmas were essentially talking to an imaginary audience as if they were doing an unboxing video on YouTube.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. And look, I'm not going to stop watching reality TV because, as Serby said, it's extremely good at allowing you to zone out for a little bit. But I do wonder, does it promote narcissism, and does it promote people copying various behaviors more so than stuff that is clearly delineated as fiction?
I think for like 95% of the people watching The Bachelor are smart, intelligent, thoughtful people. And I'm making this number up. But
did you say 95%?
I would imagine. I know a lot of very smart, thoughtful people who watch The Bachelor, including Claire.
Yeah, that's because you know a lot of smart and thoughtful people.
But they all watch The Bachelor.
But I think a lot of people in general watch The Bachelor.
Okay, fine. The point is that I think for a lot of this stuff, there's just a contingent of people who are maybe more susceptible to it. And I think another way to think about this is that people often kind of have scripts for their life about how they think about things. So like a romance is a good example in that, you know, I've met people, men, women, who feel possessive. They feel that if let's say it's a dude, let's say another dude talks to their girlfriend, they feel that it is their duty to intervene and be like, hey, stop talking to my chick, you know, she's mine, whatever, right? And they've essentially somehow internalized a script about this is the thing they should do. Now, they could have gotten that script from their parents, things they've seen, but it could also be movies doing that or TV doing that or reality TV. So I think, you know, that kind of possessive behavior, I don't know, maybe it's the minority of people, but they're probably being reinforced so that when people are acting, you know, like they are on these reality shows in this horrible, selfish way, they're probably looking at, oh, that's normal. Or maybe they're kids and are saying, not only is this normal, this is how this should be, right? When someone insults you, you're not a man unless you, you know, punch them in the face or something like that, which is may not, which is probably happening on these shows. So same thing with like violence, and you know, video games do not make people more violent, but there's a tendency for very violent people to be attracted to hyperviolent video games, and maybe there's a sort of feedback loop there.
I think that reality television does reinforce these sort of strange patterns of behavior, and I think for me, like what's most dangerous about this is the influence it has on younger generations that don't, you know, they're like a blank canvas. They have no prior experiences to understand that this is not real, that this is some sort of exaggerated version of behavior. And I think the problem comes down to parenting. Like if parents don't discuss these things, or if people just, it's like if somebody just blindly accepts information without questioning it. And I think that's something that people do less often today. And perhaps that's a result of social media or reality television, is that we just accept everything. We accept that this is how people behave. This is how people act. If somebody says something, then it's true. And I think that's maybe why reality television is tainting reality, because people are less aggressive with information, and they're less protective of what they, less protective of truth.
Here's a question. So on one end, I agree with you, Serby, or I mostly agree with you, but I always, there's this voice in the back of my head about kind of historical moral panics over children, like the Columbine Marilyn Manson thing. And I guess, is there anything from your childhood, and this applies to you as well, Jared, that you think, oh, I saw this or read this when I was a kid, and it definitely left sort of a negative impact and had to, maybe you're still like that, or maybe you've gone past it.
I think when I was growing up, these like romantic comedies and these like coming of age teen movies were quite popular. Mm. So for me, I absorbed all of these like very strange relationship dynamics between high school students and friends. And so I thought that's how it was. Like when I was in elementary school, I thought, oh, so when I get to high school, there's going to be like a love triangle. People are going to fight. Like there's just going to be all this drama. And then my mom was like, get real. Like that's not real life. And if that is your real life, you need to sort yourself out. So I think that like, that's what how I think of things. And I mean, fortunately, I had a very strong parental figure who set me straight with my incorrect beliefs. But I'm thinking of people even our age who they just don't know. They just didn't develop critical thinking skills. I mean, I think about people who idolize the Kardashians, or idolize people who are like Instagrammers. Like, why would you think that that's who you need to be like, and that's how you need to behave or how you should dress?
I mean, I still suffer from this today, to be completely honest.
We're just talking about Risky Business.
Yeah, which is one of my favorite movies. But not necessarily with reality TV, because reality TV wasn't really a thing when I was a young kid. But in terms of just my expectations for life, and in terms of what I thought would bring some sort of meaning to my life, that was all dictated to me by media. And I realize now that that's all bullshit, but I haven't found the replacement. I don't really know how, you know, where the line between how much of my desires have just been informed by outside influences that were just trying to capitalize on me, and where the real opportunity for meaning is. I don't know. I struggle with this every day.
Similar to Serby, even today when I watch sort of high school comedies, or, you know, I just watched Risky Business on the plane and was talking to Jared about it. But the sort of this, obviously not running a brothel out of your parents' house, but all the hijinks of high school and stuff like that, it still gives me a pang of like, oh man, I missed out.
Yeah.
But then I think, wait, no, it's never like that. It is never, ever like that.
I don't know. I think it is like that for some people.
For some people, sure.
I think that if you're, this is just, you know, I don't want to sound like an incel here, but I feel like if you're attractive, if you're attractive enough, you can kind of convince a group of other people to act in a certain way. And if it is emulating something that you saw on reality TV, you can pretty much get people to go along with you.
Yeah, that's fair.
I agree with you, Jared, about what you were saying about the influence of media on your career and like how you view yourself. And that's something that I struggle with. So it's not so much like relationship dynamics or like behavioral patterns, but more about at this age, should I have accomplished X, Y, and Z, or should I have already been married and should I have children? So it's things like that where I feel like I struggle with that. I've gotten better when it comes to my personal life in terms of like relationships and children, but I still struggle when it comes to career progression, that I should hit specific milestones at certain ages based on seeing my peers in media.
You know, an interesting one that I've wondered about for a while, that it certainly exists, but I think it exists prominently because of media, is the idea of love at first sight. I've heard stories, but I feel so many people, for some people it kind of grows or blossoms or however you want to say it. But like, there is somebody I know who kind of broke up with their girlfriend after years and years because it didn't conform to this idea in their head that you had to fall in love at first sight and then everything had to be perfect, which they learned not only from probably rom-coms and things like that, but also I think their parents had a perfect relationship, so that probably helped.
So the one thing I'll say about that is that I think that if two people are deluded on the same level, then it kind of becomes real. There's a great late era Woody Allen movie called You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger that didn't get a lot of critical love or box office love. I think it was made in 2011, but it was actually pretty good. And it's one of his more pessimistic films, but the ultimate conclusion is that these two lovers who are both completely delusional and believe in things like love at first sight and believe in things like crazy mysticism stuff, to them, it's real. And if they're both deluded into love at first sight, then who's to say that it doesn't actually exist?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I've rambled enough about this. Let's go on to some more Goop scams.
Oh, I'm so Serby, excited.
Why don't you reintroduce the audience to what Goop is?
Yes, I will. So for those of you who don't know, Goop is Gwyneth Paltrow's lifestyle brand, and it's full of ridiculous health claims like giving yourself a coffee enema and placing jade eggs inside sensitive areas.
You're vajayjay.
Yes.
Just say vajayjay. We're all adults here.
So recently, Gwyneth Paltrow held a wellness summit in London called In Goop Health. And at the summit, attendees had access to fireside chats in which Gwyneth Paltrow spoke with the leading researchers and doctors who come up with coffee enemas and vagina jade eggs. You could get a light therapy golden facial.
Sorry, the word golden is giving, but it's light. Is it light or golden? What is it?
Light therapy golden facial. I'm not sure, but if you had attended this wellness summit, Alec, you would have known.
I have some ideas of what it might be that are probably wildly incorrect, but I'll just imagine them anyway.
So you could take some fitness classes. You can buy items in a pop-up shop. And to everyone's shock and dismay, In Goop Health was a disaster. So one attendee said, Gwyneth acts like she's a health goddess, but actually she's a pretentious, greedy extortionist. She had a ton of security. She was unapproachable. She did the minimum. And then she put on her Birkenstocks and snuck out. I was a huge fan of Gwyneth. Now I feel like I have lost my faith in God.
Oh, gosh. Well, that's a problem in itself.
It
don't
is.
Worship now, celebrities.
Tell us more.
So it's no secret that Gwyneth and her Goop friends are dishonest and lack integrity, but It's shocking to me that people spent $5,700 to attend this wellness summit. So why would people do this, knowing with all of the articles, with all of the information that's available about Gwyneth Paltrow and her lifestyle brand? Is it the allure of being near a celebrity, or is it this illogical belief that if a celebrity sponsors something or has an organization, that it's true and that everybody else should follow it? So why? I don't understand it.
I think it's one part what you see elsewhere without celebrities, and that people create their own reality where confirmation bias, and that if there's negative press coverage of the thing you love, they're clearly paid shills, or you know, there's a witch hunt for the person, you know, flat earthers, anti-vaxxers, et cetera. This is kind of in that camp. And the other thing is, I don't know, like part of it, I don't know. I haven't talked to any of these people, obviously, but part of it might be, oh, she's famous, I want to be near someone famous. But it could also just be the same allure of a kind of thought leader, the same way that people want to be super close with Tony Robbins or even Elon Musk or any of these things. There's the allure of being someone that you feel is can give a lot of wisdom. And yeah.
All right. Well, you mentioned, both of you, I think, use the term illogical beliefs. And I guess personally, I'm kind of in a stage right now. I mentioned in either the last podcast or the previous one that I was reading the book Orthodoxy by G.K. Chesterton. And it's actually been a really interesting read that's been affecting me. I don't know. I want to say affecting me profoundly, but we'll see how I feel about it in a couple weeks. But the book is essentially, it's a piece of Christian apologetics, which basically means that a guy is defending Christianity against a lot of more, a lot of like scientific and rational and logical scrutiny. And I'm not a Christian, never have been, grew up Jewish, mostly an atheist since I was like 7. But
is that when you discovered Santa wasn't real? So you're all like,
no, I knew. I mean, I never believed Santa was real. I was grew up Jewish.
I was devastated when I found out Santa wasn't real, but also kind of relieved.
But the book is essentially using witticisms, paradoxes, essentially to make an argument for the necessity of mysticism in your life, of illogical beliefs. And I was actually planning on bringing this in some other time, but when I hear these things about Gwyneth Paltrow, now I feel, I don't feel comfortable saying like, oh yeah, these morons, or like, how could you believe something so ridiculous? How could you put your faith in something like Gwyneth Paltrow? I think that oftentimes people are driven into desperate scenarios, and it's not even necessarily that Gwyneth Paltrow is the person that is helping them. She's just the right person at the right time. They happen to be going through a crisis in life, and Goop was the thing that they went to that all of a sudden offered them a sense of clarity. This sense that we were talking about earlier of watching reality TV and it really being soothing, I think, in a sense, mysticism or illogical beliefs, whether they be religious, whether they be semi-religious, like worshiping Gwyneth Paltrow and her brand and whatever the things that ward away vampires or whatever that she sells, offers.
I think the desperation might be a little bit different. I think sometimes vulnerable people who are at really dark places of their lives often get conned by people like this. But from what I can tell, a lot of it's pseudoscience around kind of being healthier and pretty. I think it's a desperation to be healthy and attractive, which is different than the desperation of being sure, lonely and not having meaning and stuff like that. But
I was actually going to ask Serby, to connect to what we were talking about previously, even though we know and that you said that Gwyneth Paltrow was a hack, in terms of her career, do you envy her even a little bit?
No, I don't. I mean, I, in the way that I would envy anybody who gets to travel quite often or things like that, but not specifically Gwyneth Paltrow.
But so, but her achievement of creating this billion-dollar lifestyle brand doesn't hit you with any kind of envy?
No, it doesn't. If anything, it disappoints me, because I feel like with her power and influence, she could have done so many wonderful things that could affect positive change in society. And instead, she decides to spread information that is not based in facts or science, and if anything, is detrimental to people's health.
She could be like Jaden Smith, who's giving free food to homeless people right now with a vegan food truck.
Oh, is he really doing that?
Yeah.
Cool.
At least I saw an article about it. But one thing that I do agree with you, Jared, is sort of I'm also prone to using this kind of language, but saying, how could they believe this? How could they be so stupid? And I agree, we shouldn't view it quite like that, because I think it's very easy to fall into pseudoscience, and people do all the time, and very reasonable people. I hear it's not like everyone who has some pseudoscientific beliefs, you know, puts on the tinfoil hat. I've met a lot of people who just small things, maybe they're convinced that there's some government cover-up that's been disproven. Or maybe they think, you know, oh, well, doctors lie to you sometimes. And to be fair, yeah, a lot of stuff going on there. But, yeah.
So do you think, so you did it again. And what I'm asking is, so you're saying that, okay, well, it can often lead to pseudoscience, but do you universally condemn all things that are not rational and scientific? So for example, yeah.
So
I think my mom, sorry to throw my mom under the bus here, but I think my mom believes in, like, not spirits per se, but definitely, like, you know, the presence of her ancestors and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I would never criticize her for that, because what's the point? She's not doing anything to harm anybody. Yeah. It gives her comfort. She's not harming anybody.
So I think actually the important thing, and I think science has been really bad about this, is that I do think non-scientific thought is incredibly important. And I think there's a criticism among scientists to essentially say, screw, Neil deGrasse Tyson does this. He's like, why do we need philosophy? We have science, right? And that, I hate that line of thinking, right? Mm-hmm. I think as I've been engaging more with philosophy science, to me, I think the important thing is clearly demarcating what is science and is not science. So we make a lot of philosophy videos, and I think what those are, they're asking questions, they're framing things in interesting ways, they're giving you something to think about, but I would never want somebody to walk away from that and say, this is some sort of scientific, objectively proven truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think then there's science, which says, you know, we have some sense of objective truth in that we've tested these things countless times, yada, yada, yada. And I think the problem is when that demarcation goes away. And I think that's what that's the problem. So if someone is religious, for instance, and say, listen, I believe science is great. Science does all these things. But I also happen to think there's a dude in the sky, which I understand is not a scientific belief, or it's just a separate realm. I think that's fine. But it's when they say, well, because I believe there's a dude in the sky, that evolution is fake, that's when I have a problem. Or for things like Goop, which use the language of science to say this jade egg will make you healthier according to God knows what. That's where it muddies the line. That's where I think it gets super, super dangerous, because that is the sort of way that people can believe anything and everything, not only get scammed, but then lead to public health crises because people are misinformed. So for your mom, I would say it's fine. Like, as long as she's not saying, as long as she's not mixing the two.
And she's not imposing that belief on other people or necessitating that people.
I don't think imposing the, because I think, like, some people, I don't think imposing the belief is the problem, because I don't think people who are into Goop are imposing the belief. They probably just curiously bring it up and then sell someone else on their pseudoscience. For me, it's solely about the, I believe this thing, it's not scientific, it's just a belief I have. I think that's more okay, as long as it's not conflicting with actual scientific things that we know.
I think for me, when I read this, I think it comes down to the money aspect, that $5,700 is not a small sum, and people were willing to just pay that without doing any research. And I don't mean research on Gwyneth Paltrow, but I mean research on the venue. It apparently in Goop Health asked that people book directly through the website for their accommodations. But if people had booked directly with the hotel, they would have saved something like $1,300. So it's things like that where I feel like, why are people willing to just do this and just accept things? Is it just because of Gwyneth Paltrow that, or celebrity in general, that people suspend all critical thinking? Or is it like you said, that people are in a bad place? Maybe they want to belong. Maybe they want to be a part of something, and they're willing to just like do something that makes them happy.
I would say non-rational belief is one of the most valuable commodities out there. And I think that that's what allows people to extort and exploit other people. And that's when it gets really morally corrupt and disgusting. But I think you have to balance that with the recognition that the reason why people are paying so much for this is because they really, really find a very essential value to it.
Yeah. And I think I wouldn't even necessarily put it towards, obviously, spiritualism, mysticism is probably part of the Goop brand, but I think it extends well beyond that. And that kind of your point, Jared, a super lucrative commodity is self-improvement. And we see this everywhere. There's those CEO retreats where they do hot yoga for 18 hours a day and are paying God knows how much money. You know, there's Tony Robbins has these super expensive retreats. Even in the 60s and 70s, I think one was called like Ursulon, where you'd scream in a hotel room at each other. And these things have always been incredibly expensive. Generally, I can't speak for all of them, incredibly exploitative. It's, I think when it comes to improving yourself, people, it's hard to put a price tag to it.
Yeah.
Because people will spend as much money as they possibly have.
All of Scientology is based on this.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. All right, we're going a little bit long, so let's go on to the next one. Alec, you got YouTube demonetizing the news. Hooray, hooray.
Yeah, so this has been an issue that's been going on for a while, but specifically on Medium, on their 1.0 publication. So YouTube keeps demonetizing Hong Kong protest. For anyone who doesn't know, Hong Kong, there's been a lot of protest because the Hong Kong government is trying to make a bill that people are saying would allow Hong Kong citizens to be extradited to China for Chinese crimes. So the important thing to understand is that Hong Kong for almost 20 years now or over 20 years has been part of China. It was formerly British. But there's this idea called One China, Two Systems, which is that China considers them one country. However, Hong Kong has its own government, its own laws, et cetera, et cetera. So a part of the population values this autonomy, and allowing Hong Kong citizens to be extradited there is a problem. Anyway, that's what the protest is about. The problem is that when certain YouTube channels are doing news coverage about the protest, which as far as I can tell, haven't been violent. I think police have been using tear gas at times and all that kind of stuff, but it's not like people stabbing each other in the streets. YouTube is demonetizing them because they're not advertiser friendly. And it raises the interesting question about what is or isn't advertiser friendly. This is from the article. Creators of at least two Hong Kong-based YouTube channels covering the demonstrations say that videos and even whole channels have been demonetized by the tech platform. That means YouTube won't run ads next to their content, and thus creators can't make money from its advertising program. Now, it's important to note that even the people being demonetized said this wasn't part of some YouTube-Google conspiracy to side with the Chinese government, but just that because it is civil strife, it is not suitable for advertisers. We've actually...
But that's bullshit. I mean, CNN makes probably the most money out of any person on television running ads on sensationalized news about political strife.
Yeah, and the article points out a kind of double standard because you can find lots of videos about the Hong Kong protests that are fine, and it seems like as you become a bigger, more powerful company, you have more sway. And I would even say we exist kind of somewhere in the middle in that we've had videos demonetized. We'll get in touch with our rep or whoever, and oftentimes, not all the time, they'll fix it. But I feel like they listen to us because we're bigger. But I've seen stories of smaller YouTubers who it's like talking to a wall. There's no way they can get in touch with anyone. So there is this kind of double standard. I have much more to say about this, but I want to get initial thoughts.
And this is one of the reasons I hate Silicon Valley, because these people are fucking clowns. I mean, look, I don't think this is an easy problem to solve. And obviously, Google's a business. They don't want all their advertisers to run to the hills. Advertisers don't want to be put in front of fucking pedophile videos or certain things that are casting doubt on the Holocaust or something like that. But, you know, I think it was Russell Brand who said that totalitarianism is the willful suspension of nuance. And I really, really like that statement. And I feel like Google, I don't know if it's just the people who work there are unable to process nuance or they're just unwilling to. But for example, and I'm sure you're going to bring this up, Alec, is that we did a video on talking about Hitler discourse, just talking about the way that we talk about Hitler and how that has to do with Holocaust remembrance and stuff like that. And it was demonetized just for the fact that we were talking about things in which minorities were persecuted.
And what's interesting is it was written, researched, and narrated by three Jews? Were there four Jews involved in that process? The main scholar we cite is a Jewish historian. So,
you know, honestly, that doesn't, although I would,
that shouldn't matter.
I would throw that in Google's face just because I know they react to that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I just want to say,
I don't give a shit.
No, I know. It's just sort of like a rhetorical, how dare you kind of thing I want to say to them. But
yeah, I really want to go up to Google's face and says, do you guys not want to remember the Holocaust? Cause I'm sure they would all put their tails through their legs and freak the fuck out if I dared say that.
No, but the thing is, it's this wildly dehumanizing process to go through it because it'll say you violated YouTube's hate speech policy. And then you'll be like, what hate speech is there? And then they'll just copy and paste the thing that you can see on their advertiser guidelines. And it'll say, you know, hate speech disparages or encourages, you know, violence against, you know, marginalized groups, including XYZ.
So it's literally saying that we should deny the Holocaust because we can't even recognize that hate speech occurred.
Right. So essentially the policy reads like, you shouldn't do hate speech, but instead it's being interpreted as or being administered as don't talk about the fact that it exists. And this is brought up in the article. It says, read literally, the company's guidelines would seem to rule out ads on huge swaths of what is generally considered mainstream news coverage. Imagine your evening newscast stripped of any stories whose topics include violence, harmful or dangerous acts, tobacco, firearms, or, quote, controversial issues and sensitive events. Note further that YouTube's explanation of that last category includes war, death and tragedies, political conflicts, terrorism or extremism, and sexual abuse. You'd be left with the local sports roundup, the winning lottery numbers, and weather report, assuming one supposes the weather isn't causing any deaths or tragedies.
I'm already getting pissed off.
Serby, what's your initial thoughts?
So I don't know too much about how YouTube and advertisements work. So do organizations say these are the types of videos that we would like our ads to be played alongside, or how does that work?
Obviously brands like Johnson & Johnson and Dove Soap are not going to sponsor true crime things like Forensic Files, for example. But Forensic Files does have advertisers, or they're not going to advertise Jerry Springer. It's just that Google is too lazy to figure out an algorithm that would match the appropriate sponsors with content that is adult oriented. They'd rather just throw everything under the bus and say, oh, well, that's not sponsor friendly.
Yeah. So there's targeting like, oh, gamer audience or this or that or these topics. Right. And so there's kind of two kinds of, there's total demonetization, which is no ads. And in fact, one video by this channel, Three Arrows, I believe, written by a PhD historian about the Holocaust and Nazism, was just totally taken off. Like, the video was deleted. They eventually reinstated it. So there's total demonetization. There's being taken down, but there's also limited advertising, which says may not be suitable for many or some advertisers, which just tanks your revenue. And now I would be totally cool with a scenario where, listen, if Coca-Cola doesn't want to sponsor, you know, the Civil War documentary by Ken Burns because, you know, it shows gruesome images of dead people, I get it. If they're making that choice, I could make larger complaints about that, but fine. But it's just, I'm not entirely sure I want to look into this. I imagine it's a check mark about whether or not you're interested in covering sensitive topics. And so I think for people who want to be brand safe, they're not doing specific, because it's all programmatic, they're not looking into the individual videos or channels. They're just like checking boxes. So again, it's totally fine if, you know, a company doesn't want to get involved in a certain current event. But what this is leading to is a scenario where educational channels specifically, you know, there's another small YouTuber that I met at last year's VidCon who makes videos about the history of anti-Semitism, which I would say is a worthy thing of learning about, but those videos don't get demonetized. So if he's making a business decision, he might as well make videos about the history of dogs because it's cuter and advertiser friendly. So it's this terrible dystopia, and the algorithm is opaque. They won't actually tell you, right? Like, if you ask specific questions, they'll just copy and paste the paragraph that you violated. And if you ask, like, I've tried asking questions about, hey, we're thinking about making history content. Where should we stand on these kinds of things? Should we avoid these topics? And it's crickets because they don't want to say anything that would possibly anger anyone. Sorry, does that answer your question?
It does. Rambling. And it's distressing because it feels as if like they're weaponizing monetization so that you're essentially forced, everybody is essentially forced to narrow the scope of topics that they can discuss. So if you have a business that's based off of making YouTube videos and you're not going to get monetized for the history of anti-Semitism and you'd rather talk about dogs, then that means there's this whole knowledge base that people miss out on because they can't make money from it. So that's upsetting.
Yeah. I mean, the larger problem is that we live in a society where, first of all, the majority of public speech is dictated by platforms owned by Silicon Valley. Like, it is harder and harder and less likely to, you know, there's no agora or town square to go to and meet your fellow citizens. I mean, I guess you could hang out in the park and talk to strangers, but people would think you're creepy. You know, protesting, you know, you would. It's harder and harder. You have to now get licenses, permits to organize protests or have any sort of thing. So it's like our public spaces are continually being destroyed and our outlets for public discourse and are being relegated into these privately owned corporations. And I think it's a thing that the right talks about in a certain way because they're mad that, you know, certain things are being demonetized. And the left will say, oh, good, we're getting these right-wing people off, but aren't realizing that it's also hurting left-wing causes. Like, a while ago when YouTube had a similar panic, they demonetized a ton of content by like gay people about their you know, the gay community. So it's like every time the left asks for a thing and then cheers, they're kind of ignoring the other thing that's hurting them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know this, but I imagine just from the decisions being made that Google is employing people to make these calls because Google equates hysterics with moral elevation.
Explain.
Because if you are more sensitive to saying that something is offensive, you're therefore right. So if, for example...
I don't think that's true, though, because...
I just think... I mean, I don't know. I'm imagining a room of five people at Google and a bunch of... And one out of the five says, oh, this is highly offensive, and the other four out of the five being too cowardly to defend them.
See, I think you're making it more human. I think what happened is... You know, PewDiePie pissed somebody off and they say, man, we got to really appeal to sponsors. So it's interesting. It kind of goes back to our bullshit jobs conversation in that there's this idea of a box ticker who is someone who records a job being done that's not actually being done. And I feel like this algorithm that they've created to determine what is and isn't monetizable and advertiser friendly is only there to somehow assure advertisers that we swear your content isn't going to end up in these terrible places, regardless of whether or not that's actually true. I mean, in painting such a broad stroke, they probably are making sure it doesn't end up on certain things, but they've eliminated so many people. So I think it's just the appearance to advertisers that they're doing something. I don't think there's a human element of... I don't think any humans are discussing this. I think probably minimum.
Well, we know for a fact that they are.
No, but I think it's a room full of people probably like outsourced to some other country where you can pay people $5 a day who look at the sheet of paper. And there's stories about people who do this for Facebook who will just look at things that have been flagged by users to say, does this violate the terms of service? So they just look at gory images all day and figure out, is it or isn't it against the terms of service? And it's just like, it's not some CEO sitting in a room. It's just these poorly paid people who, you know, get really depressed because all they do is look at weird racist shit all day or weird violent shit all day.
Yeah, I'm tempted to bring up an example to ask what you guys think about. Yeah, let's just fuck it. Let's just do it. All right. So there was a YouTuber. She was a young girl. I showed you this person before. She was like, she's 14 years old and she has these what she calls satirical YouTube videos that tackle a whole bunch of stuff. And her entire channel got taken down and she has something like a million subscribers. But what ended up getting her entire channel taken down, or maybe just a strike, was that she made a joke saying, what's the CEO of YouTube's name? Like Susan Wojcicki, whatever her name is. She says, Susan, I'm taking an Uber. I'll be there in 7 minutes to kill you. So obviously... I just think that there's no critical thinking being applied. I don't think that people at Silicon Valley understand what a joke is. They don't understand that things can be... They're just always leaning towards this is bad, better safe than sorry. But obviously, it's not a real... If the concern is that it's a real threat, well, the video went up 10 minutes ago. Obviously, she wasn't there in 7 minutes to kill her.
See, but I don't think it's not about people not understanding jokes. It's like the bureaucratization of determining these things, and that there's so much content on Facebook, on YouTube, wherever, and there's so many people involved in the process. And also, for PR reasons, they say, we need to create a policy, and the policy needs to seem fair, so we have to enforce it by the letter, right?
Well, in that particular example, it actually did go all the way up to the CEO herself, and she made that decision. Obviously, she feels personally attacked. I get it. It seems odd to me because I think that there are a lot of people out there who, with the same hint of ironicism, wish that she was quote-unquote dead. I'm not saying that people actually wish her to be dead, but in the same way that a lot of people wish that Donald Trump was dead or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just tricky because if you're... I think they don't want to be in the business... It's a business. They don't want to be in the business of determining what is and isn't a real death threat. So they're just going to, you know, take a broad stroke and eliminate all the death threats, whether or not they're made in irony. And from a perspective of we have to do this in scale, essentially, that makes sense. I know it did go all the way up to her. But yeah, she probably want to send a message. And I mean, I'm not even saying like I agree or disagree, but it's just... Yeah, it's because it's such a bureaucracy, it's totally dehumanizing.
Yeah.
Serby, were you going to say something?
I think from a business perspective, I can understand why YouTube does this. And I do think that it was a few meetings with humans, and then the rest is now there's some sort of like code that was written that now like takes things down. And then if something gets flagged that's serious, they'll have like another human discussion. But from a business perspective, I can understand why this was done. You have millions of dollars of advertising revenue at stake. And if one organization has their product filmed alongside a video of like, I don't know, an ISIS beheading video, mm-hmm. like that could cause that organization to then pull their ads from YouTube. So I do mm-hmm. get it. It does make sense. I think that Google needs to be more strategic about what they do and create algorithms that are not smarter, but like more focused on the types of videos that are actually bad. Like, let's not have a blanket ban on everything. Let's try to have a ban on videos that are actually awful.
Absolutely. All right, let's move on. So next thing I want to talk about is true crime. So true crime content is everywhere and increasingly dominating the media landscape. And actually, a lot of what I'm going to talk about is pretty much an overlap with reality TV. So according to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, 44% of podcast listeners listened to a true crime podcast in the last month. That's almost half. This was a 2018 survey, and it was a 30% increase from 2017. And also, according to the ABC, this surge was mostly women. So, of course, everybody knows the Serial podcast. It was the fastest podcast to reach 5 million downloads. Making a Murderer is Netflix's most significant show ever. In fact, in the week of December 28th, 2015, nearly 1 in 5 adults were watching Making a Murderer. So I'm going to list off true crime stuff just on Netflix. Conversations with a Killer, the Ted Bundy tapes, Out of Thin Air, Making a Murderer, The Keepers, Brother's Keeper, The Disappearance of Madeleine McCann, Casting JonBenet, Longshot, Evil Genius, The Murder Detectives, The Fear of 13, The Innocent Man, The Staircase, Amanda Knox, Team Foxcatcher, Strong Island, Sour Grapes, Newton, Wild Wild Country, Wormwood, The 7-5, A Murder in the Park, Interview with a Serial Killer, Belief, The Possession of Janet Moses, Shadow of Truth, Abducted in Plain Sight, I Am a Killer, The Confession Tapes. This is just one platform. But my question here is, has this boom gotten cynical? So there's a podcast that I won't name that when I learned about it and I listened to, it really got me thinking that, okay, something is fucked up here. Because this podcast makes a shit, and it's also one that's on a very big network. It makes a shit ton of money interviewing people whose loved ones are missing. The show is basically structured as brief introduction to the case, phone call with this person's loved one as they break down crying about the person's whereabouts, cut to commercial.
I was trying to remember, Serby, what is that series on TV? It's always like a 60-minute documentary about someone who went missing or was murdered.
Is this not Forensic Files?
No, it's been there since like the 90s, and I think they're still on.
Oh, is maybe it like on ABC or something where it's like
it's always
Cold
on one
Case
of those.
Or something? Not Cold Case.
I think maybe I've just watched 18 different shows and assumed they were all the same thing. But it's always like your interview. There's this mystery and they're interviewing. And you can always figure out who did it by who's in a separate room in the interview. So like if the husband did it, he'll be not with the rest of the family because they're interviewing him from prison. But they make it look like it's not prison.
Anyway, so there's a couple things here. There's actually a great article in the Elon Law Review called The Whole Truth, The Implication of America's True Crime Obsession. So I think this woman is a lawyer, and she I did not write down her name, unfortunately. I apologize to whoever wrote this.
Miss Lawyer Lady.
Miss Lawyer Lady.
Esquire.
She says, the genre of true crime has typically sought to understand the monster and purpose behind real criminal acts, or in a modern trend, focus on cases with questionable endings. As a result, the line between fact and fiction is often blurred for entertainment value or simply to prove a point. So there's the one thing I mentioned earlier about how as soon as content producers get wind that there's a demand for true crime content, it becomes cynical so quickly, then it's time to sensationalize every murder, every victim, to dramatize real-world nightmares in order to optimize entertainment. And I guess to overlap with what I was talking about with reality TV, I do wonder how this idea of turning real-life cases into entertainment and dramatizing reality, if it's not, it's maybe not such a great thing. So what this writer, this lawyer, talks about is that true crime may be harming America's perception of the criminal justice system to an unmerited extent just by the necessity of dramatizing these things so that every episode ends on a cliffhanger, or that it's just structured properly to where you'll watch the next episode or that you'll binge season two. And I just think that, I mean, like everything in the economy, once there's a hit, once there's a way to make money, a lot of considerations just get thrown out the window because if you're not going to race to the bottom, somebody else is.
You know, and I think it's sad because I think there's a lot of actual good journalism that sometimes follows these cases. So Serial, I think, was great. And I think it was great because I think Sarah Koenig contextualizes a lot of it in terms of not only do you learn things about the criminal justice system, problems in the criminal justice system, how evidence is used. And I feel like...
Yeah, but how do you know she didn't sensationalize it or at least structured it in a way that you would watch as soon as episode four ended, you wanted to watch episode five? And how do you know...
No, she probably did do that. But I mean, it's the balance of even journalists are storytellers. Obviously, they're storytellers who are bound to the facts.
Who's binding them?
Who's nobody, but and that's, I mean, that's where a good journalist gets. I mean, there are good journalists out there who have a good track record of telling the facts as they are in a good, compelling way, right?
Isn't there a set of rules or something that journalists must adhere to?
Yeah, but these
people are not journalists. These people are just entertainers,
right? Oh. So Sarah Koenig is a journalist.
Yeah, that not talking about her,
right? Sure. I mean, but other examples like Reply All did like a mini series about a guy. They consider themselves journalists. Again, I don't know who's binding them to anything. I think the tragedy of these things, though, is that we get so caught up in the sensational details that we miss an opportunity to reflect on it as a whole. And I think that's what makes good true crime journalism. We can either reflect on the criminal justice system or why these people were drawn to it, not drawn to do these things in this sort of singular sense, but, you know, is addiction driving these murders? Is this or that driving these murders? There's like a lot of good opportunities for that. But if it's just how do I tell a good whodunit, all of that gets lost.
I'm curious about the spike in these types of stories. And I wonder if it's because people crave reality. Like there's so much like fake shit in our lives nowadays. Like, do people just want something that's real? I mean, even though it's sensationalized and we're trivializing people's grief and things like that, but as a consumer, like, our consumer is more interested in things that are real. Is that why true crime?
Yeah. So there's,
I think these have always been very popular. Like,
yeah.
I want to call it Dateline, whatever those specials are.
I'm telling you, it's Forensic Files.
That's probably also a thing, but whatever.
I think it is actually Dateline.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. I think it's the same narrator.
Probably all the same narrator. They're probably all made in the same basement in like 20 hours, and then there's like 2 years worth of content. Anyway, I mean, even like the reason Jack the Ripper is well known today is because the story of Jack the Ripper was trendy in newspapers to report about and talk about. It was salacious. It was, you know, there was mystery. It's all these good things of good sensationalist journalism.
But do you think that he would still be as infamous if he killed men instead of women?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Serby, do you watch any or listen to any true crime content as the spokesperson for all women?
No, I used to watch Criminal Minds, but it made me extremely paranoid. And I'm already kind of a jumpy person. So I had to like put a ban on that for myself, like to not watch things like that. I am obsessed with serial killers, though. Not like I don't like. They're not, it's not like a fetish or something for me. I know like a lot of people, like they're sexually attracted to serial killers. It's not like that for me. It's more of just the psychology, like what drives somebody to do that. But no, in general, I don't watch things like that, mostly because I feel like I'm already an anxious person at baseline. Wouldn't do great things for my health.
So to maybe answer your question, Serby, there's an article in Brandwatch by a writer named Gemma Joyce, and she claims that women are so into true crime stories for two reasons. One, it gives you a chance to think about and experience these brutal murders with a degree of safety and separation from the real crimes. And two, women have real concerns about becoming victims of these crimes, and it gives them a chance to learn about it and even get tips to stay safe. Does that resonate with you?
Yes, absolutely. So I always feel like men, I know everybody has it quite difficult, but one of the ways in which I think men have it easier than women is that you can walk down the street and not feel afraid that somebody's going to like grab you and rape you. Or anytime I'm in an elevator and a man gets on and it's just the two of us, I am nervous the entire time until I get off the elevator.
My biggest fear is that they'll just talk to me.
My biggest fear is that they'll rape me.
I'm not discounting that. I'm just comparing our two concerns.
And it's scary. And so I can see why women would be interested in watching these videos and these shows and things. And for anyone out there who is interested in discovering ways and techniques to not save yourself, but I guess to develop those skills to help prevent putting yourself in those situations, you should read The Gift of Fear. It's a fantastic book, and it's all about trusting your instincts. And I think it would appeal to these women that watch these shows in order to prevent these scenarios.
Yeah. I mean, I think Gemma Joyce's two points are pretty apt. I think where I'm just coming down on this whole podcast is that narrativizing things is a little bit troublesome, especially when it becomes sensationalizing it and it becoming more important that it's consumable entertainment that gets a lot of views or gets a lot of watches or gets a lot of buys than it is to accurately retell the story. And I know that's not a new criticism by any means, but it's the cynicism, man. All right, that's pretty much all I've got. Serby, do you have time to maybe answer one or two mailbag questions?
We have two short emails.
Sure.
Let's do it. By the way, if you guys want to send us a voicemail, your thoughts about any of the topics we've talked about today or any questions, or if you want to tell us to go fuck ourselves, 213-534-8807, 21ELFGUT07, or send us an email. We now have a Culture Binge dedicated email, so culturebinge@wisecrack.co. Once again, that's .co, not .com. Some other dude owns that domain, and he's asking a lot of money for it. But anyway, Alec.
All right. So I got a long email from Carl. I've abridged it a little bit for time. He had 5 points. I boiled it down 3. Whatever. Thanks, Carl, for sending us the email. So I've got a few comments about the topics discussed here. I don't normally watch YouTube Live, but it was on, and I needed a good podcast while I did my chores. I have a personal take on each topic that I hope you at Wisecrack enjoy. Again, I'm only selecting a few. Deepfakes. The thing that's scary about deepfakes, especially early on, when they're just real enough to be believed by the average person, has one really nasty implication that I think you guys ignored, even though the law they modified directly relates to it. The law was concerned with revenge porn, and this is important because if the average person fakes a video of an ex in a porno, they can send that video to their ex's boss and get them fired. So that's point one. I think that's a great point.
Yeah, but this goes back to what we were talking about with Google. If this employer is not willing to look into it and say that, oh, well, I can probably figure out if this is fake or not, if they're just like, oh, something that even looks like controversy, you're fired, that's also a tragedy.
Yeah, or just, I mean, so many hiring decisions are made on Snap Decisions. So if you Google image search and you're like, oh, whoa. Anyway. So Gina,
don't Google image search. I'm a very, very firm proponent of separating your work life from your personal life. I once was at a job where I had to pay for the company shirt that I have to wear when I'm on the clock. But they also said that you can't go drinking or partying when wearing that shirt. And I thought that was complete bullshit. You know, when I hire people at Wisecrack, I don't give a shit what your politics are. I don't give a shit, you know, what you do, what you post about. As long as you're good at your job, I end it there.
Which is why Serby's going to have a fruitful mukbang career.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry,
so
I didn't want to go on that rant, but...
All right. So Gina had a baby is also from Carl. This is a much shorter answer because even if the technology was perfect, this isn't moral because it's essentially fancy eugenics.
Mm.
And now my opinion of Uwe Boll is he makes shitty movies I don't have time for, so I don't care.
That is a
like
fair
Carl.
Assessment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank
thanks,
you,
Carl.
That is fair. I think the young aspirational filmmaker in me and where I am right now in life just kind of sees him and is like, man, I can learn something from you.
I hope so, Carl writes in again because I enjoyed
yeah,
his
Carl,
thought.
Write again. Yeah. All right. So here's our last email from Josh. Hey, I'm currently listening to your deepfake stream and you're chatting about designer babies and what the possible future may look like. Which for sure could be pretty bleak, especially as society already seems to produce a number of eerily accurate facsimiles of Kim Kardashian as well as other celebs. And it seems like we could accidentally enter into an unintentional sorting algorithm of sorts that reduces human variation to a singular, self-similar permutation. However, there is an interesting work of philosophy slash bioethics as to why it's no biggie, or at least some interesting counterpoints to the usual worries people raise. In that book that is called Beyond Humanity, The Ethics of Biomedical Enhancement by Alan Buchanan, I believe. I haven't checked out the book. I am interested. Yeah, thank you for the recommendation.
Thank you. That's interesting. I'm going to look into it a little bit more because I've been thinking a lot about this topic and then this egg freezing thing. It's been on my mind lately.
Mm.
You know, how different is this than if we're actually, so he's saying that that the concern is that there will be this homogeneity of individuals once you can choose what your baby has and has not.
Yeah, we're all going to look like
Can't we just, and I think this is largely true, but I think a good example of this is can't we just look at avatars in things like World of Warcraft? So, I mean, I'm going to flash my nerd card here, but I played World of Warcraft when it first came out in 2005.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you did.
Yeah, I did. And I was part of the undead race, and we were outnumbered like 7-1 from the others that were like the more attractive races, like the humans and the elves. And I always thought that was fucking bullshit. And I think that, yeah, once you can choose your avatar and you want to be pretty, you want to be handsome, then people are just going to choose that.
I mean, this already...
But at the same time, if everyone's doing that, then doesn't the idea of beauty just kind of go away?
No, because it's always like a standard that's dictated by how much money you have. Like this already exists in that, you know, if, God, this is so old. If Jennifer Aniston is the thing to emulate, you're going to get the Rachel haircut. Or if you're...
yeah, but that's because Jennifer Aniston is unique in that she's more attractive than most people. But if we're living in a Second Life-like setting where the way that we interact with people and everybody is as beautiful as Jennifer Aniston, then she's still going to be beautiful.
I think that'll be dictated by... what people have the money to sort of bioengineer their children to.
So reality is going to be like Fortnite.
Yeah. Who has money for the hottest real life skin? I mean, yeah. A similar thing is that like Korean women often whiten their skin to look like, you know, Hollywood stars or whatever. Yeah. So we're already in the dystopia, but it's going to get so much worse.
Yay.
Also, it's not like us selecting what we want to look like. It's our parents. So
yeah.
I think that's a problem
point.
Too. I think if there were a way where at like 25 or 30 years old, we can select what we look like, then I think it could be like a wow game. But until then, we would all just be, beauty would be informed by like cultural standards. And like, for example, the Indian culture is very similar to Korean culture. Everybody wants to be very fair. But in other places, perhaps you would, you're better looking if you have more curves or if you're darker skinned. So,
yeah. What if, for instance, you know, your parents didn't want you to be hairy because like hairy men are unattractive at the time, but then 20 years later, dad bods and hairy bodies are popular, and then your parents have just screwed you over for life.
Well, that's something that I don't even know if this is like appropriate to discuss on the podcast, but like laser hair removal for women, a lot of women had laser hair removal that's fairly permanent in specific areas. And then with like age or trends or things like that, they've decided, they've wished that they hadn't done laser hair removal in those areas. Yeah. And there's no reversing that. So I think what's trending at the time could inform beauty standards. And yeah. I would hate for it to be permanent.
Yeah.
Isn't that what a merkin is?
What's a merkin?
It's like a, it's a wig for those areas. Isn't, right?
Oh, no, but tell me more. Do you know more?
No, because Mike's production company is called the Merkin Bros, and that's what he told me at one point. I think that's what he told me. I don't know. Anyway, we're going to cut it here. Thank you guys so much for listening. Again, if you're listening to this on the YouTube channel Wisecast, be sure to subscribe to the RSS feed. It's on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, all that stuff. We're going to try and live stream again next week if the schedule allows. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening. Thank you, Serby. Thank you, Alec. And we'll see you guys next week. Thanks,
bye.
Guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.